It's going down, and you're invited for what they selling. We ain't buying. There is no running, there is no hiding. There's only fighting or dying. It's going down, and you're invited for what they selling. We ain't buying. There is no running, there is no hiding. There's only fighting or dying.
It's Going Down is a digital community center from anarchist, anti-fascist, autonomous, anti-capitalist, and anti-colonial movements. Our mission is to provide an autonomous and resilient platform to publicize and promote revolutionary theory and action.
Go to itsgoingdown.org for daily updates. Check out our online store for ways to donate and rate and follow us on iTunes if you like this podcast. Okay, we're joined here today with Shane Burley. Shane, thanks so much for joining us. I know last night you just did a talk with Mark Bray. He also has a book out. He's been on the podcast. Kind of like an all-star anti-fascist book lineup. How did the event go? Was there a lot of people?
Yeah, it went great. There was almost 200 people there.
Holy shit.
Yeah, it was massive. They had to just pack people in there, standing room only. Which I guess shows exactly what's on people's minds and stuff right now. And we had a big support from local groups like Roasted Antifa and other groups and around town that really came out and forced to support it and be a part of the conversation. And we talked for a little bit and then just took lots of questions. And it was mainly good and kind of incident free.
Awesome. Any highlights you want to share? What was on people's minds? Any kind of weird oddball questions, or what was the general tone of the event?
Well, the only really oddball question was the first question, someone announced themselves that they're from the 9/11 Truth Alliance, which was a nice red flag first. And then I asked them to say their name, and I remembered the name from a campaign against them a number of years ago for dealing with Holocaust deniers. So I just cut that question off and said, we're moving on. And they got up and left, and we just kind of kept rolling with it.
You say, I am actually from Tower 7 Antifa.
Right. I'm actually a demolition expert. I was there. Yeah. It can't melt steel beams. And then so, like, we just kind of walked past it, just said, okay, we're just going to go on to the next people. There was a lot of questions just about, you know, what we think different things mean. A lot of questions about media portrayals and why the media gets it so wrong a lot of the time. Uh-huh. That we spent a lot of time talking about that. Some questions about how to reach out to rural folks, especially like rural union members. And then a lot of really broad questions, like how do you find left unity to fight these sorts of things? And, you know, what's effective strategically? And I think that's always a tough question because it's situational and it really depends on what a community looks like.
Mm-hmm. All right. Well, just to be clear, the book is called Fascism Today, What It Is and How to End It. It's published by AK Press. You can go onto the AK Press website and order it now. It's shipping into stores soon. But let's just talk about the book. What is its main argument? And what is it about?
So, I mean, it's kind of broken up into two sections. So the first part is really just discussing what fascism is and what it looks like. It kind of starts by setting the stage of what the last couple of years have looked like. Trump, but also really the alt-right. And that's the kind of the main image of fascism we have in the book, because in the U.S. that is the main image of what fascism is looks like here as an insurrectionary white nationalist movement. It's kind of the alt-right is the front face of it. So we spent a lot of time talking about that, breaking down the kind of history of that. What's their key ideas and arguments? How do they see themselves? How have they kind of operated throughout history? And then kind of different subsets of that. How does the militia movement work and how does it kind of relate to the rest of the nationalists? How do religious formations work in regards to that? Different things like that. So it kind of breaks down, I guess you say, the enemy side of it. And then the second half just talks about all kinds of different avenues of resistance that people have taken, different types of organizations, different models that people have had. Some things have been successful, some things that have been less successful. And then kind of breaks down what people's options have been and what that resistance looks like.
And in the book, I mean, do you see fascism as something that's an auxiliary movement? It's primarily on the streets, made up by different groups and formations, or is this something that's also growing in the halls of power You know, is Trump a fascist, do you think? This is something that people have argued about over and over again, but what is your thoughts on that?
I think it's really hard to say. I you know, there's been this long debate in the first 6 months of his, like, where his candidacy really hit like a fever pitch. And there's all these, you know, hot takes on, is Trump a fascist? No, he's a right populist. No, he's more like a proto-fascist. I think it's difficult to say without putting it through this kind of academic rigmarole. I think what we can say is that his populist movement is a fascist enabler and has the potential to become a full-fledged fascist movement in the state. I don't think at this point, though, it's quite there yet. I think in a lot of ways what we have as a fascist movement is what we have in the streets. I think it would be hyperbolic to say that anything, at least in Western Europe or the U.S., anything over the last couple of decades could really be called fascist. You know, people love to call like the Bush White House fascist, but it really doesn't meet those things. It really just has the same authoritarian features of state and capitalism that we've had for years, maybe just in a hyper-realized way. What's different about Trump and the alt-right as kind of the auxiliary to that is that it's open in its nativism, or in the case of the alt-right, in its white nationalism. It's America first. It's really turned in on itself in a way that capitalism only codes. It's made it explicit. And so I think in a lot of ways, what we're dealing with when we say fascism that's actually here and growing, it is that more insurrectionary alt-right movement, one that's not inside the state, but would love to have the power of the state.
Right now marks the one-year anniversary since his election. But I mean, looking back on the past year, are you surprised at what you've seen? I mean, did your own predictions kind of play out, or what has surprised you over the past year, both in terms of the Trump regime, but also in terms of the auxiliary alt-right intermingling with that and also doing their own thing?
I think it's all been surprising. You know, I didn't bet that Trump would have won. I'd love to say I had the foresight. I did not at all. I thought it was obvious that some centrist corporate candidate like Hillary would sweep in. And in fact, it really shows the fragments in capitalism right now. As late capitalism really starts to implode on itself, like these are the kinds of things that become potentials. So I think it's all surprising. You know, I was watching the alt-right for a number of years before it kind of blew up. But even then, I was surprised when it started to. And there's been a number of subsequent kind of peaks in its evolution. They've all surprised me. I think it's really hard to bet on these things because in a lot of ways, when a fascist movement has power or rises to power, all bets are off. Like it's really hard to predict because you have to use the old models for prediction to see what's going to happen. And those don't apply anymore. So I think those rise have kind of been surprising. What's not surprising is the acts of violence that they're starting to turn to. That's not surprising. It's not surprising that Trump is bumbling his presidency, that this first year has been essentially without much heavy result, except for, you know, rising the kind of right-wing American id. But policy-wise, he's not being very successful. That's not surprising. But I think there's a lot of things in their rise that have been so surprising that when we go into 2018, we can predict a lot of things on our side, but it is going to be hard to predict sometimes where their support's going to come from.
Right. Do you have any predictions? Do you have any analysis that you want to share as far as 2018? I mean, we just saw, you know, the beginning of, you know, some progressives winning. You know, obviously as anarchists, we are not as interested in that as, you know, social movements. But I mean, I think it does speak to the fact that there is a rising, you know, anger against not only Trump, but also all the economic and social and environmental factors that, you know, are obviously are still here just as much as they were during the 2016 election. But do you have any insights that you want to share about 2018?
Yeah, I think all those DSA, Democratic Socialist America candidates winning is to a degree a sign of that. I mean, I think we'd agree it's too little too late to do much substantive in a lot of those races. But I'm not as cynical as to say I think it's necessarily a bad thing. I would like to see that energy put into on the ground social movements rather than just like planning for midterm elections or something that gets us back into the same corporate cycle. I think there's a couple things. One is that there is a pattern of white nationalist movements that I don't want to say it's eternal, but repeats itself so often. It's one of the things I would set my watch by, which is that white nationalist movements have a point where they rise in popularity and influence. They then kind of connect with maybe a slightly more moderate version of themselves. So like in the 80s and 90s, white nationalism tried to kind of linger around libertarianism and paleoconservatism. That was like slightly more moderate, but still a part of like mainstream conservatism. And that helped the mainstream other ideas. So we had people like Pat Buchanan or Chronicles Magazine or Human Events, like, and those kind of helped, you know, push their anti-immigrant message and help really launch that as a movement in the 90s, or during like the area of the battle over segregation, the pro-segregationist side, in a lot of ways was kind of the above ground movement for the third era KKK. And there's a number of versions of this. Today we had the alt-right with what we call the alt-light, so the kind of slightly more moderate, more populist version of the alt-right, which would be like the Breitbarts of the world, Lauren Southern, Ann Coulter, Steve Bannon, Rebel Media, that kind of stuff. But what happens inevitably in every one of these patterns is eventually the more moderate sphere can't tolerate the more radical version of themselves anymore, and they reject and betray them. That further alienates the more radical white nationalist wing, and they inevitably turn to violence out of their desperation. And that's played out so uniformly over the years that it seems as though we're hitting that period now with the alt-right, where they're starting to be abandoned by their kind of slightly more mainstream comrades. And with all the platform denial that's been happening since Charlottesville, they've been kicked off of Twitter, they're getting kicked off their web hosting. It's becoming very difficult for them to do basic operational functions. That, I think, leads us to a place of saying they don't have a lot of options, and that's when quote-unquote leaderless resistance begins. And that's when you see kind of seemingly random acts of violence. And that's, I think, really frightening. And that's something I don't want to say I'm predicting, but that is the kind of thing I'm bracing myself for. Mm-hmm. I think in terms of Trump, it's hard to say, because I think he is personally, as an individual, it seems to be slightly less ideological than those he surrounds himself with. So it could be simply as much as whatever works to kind of for his personal ego. And, you know, if it seems as though if he sticks on things like their semi-cultural issues, he tends to win a little bit more favor from his base. And so I'd be surprised if he backed away from immigration and the border wall. He could do things like set his sight on organized labor, which would lose him a lot of support in a lot of the Beltway. A lot of middle America. The Beltway would love it. But at this point, it's hard to say what he thinks is strategic. So he's just going to throw stuff at the wall and see if it fits. But I think an all-out assault on immigrants, and especially Muslim Americans, is what he's going to be turning to in 2018.
I mean, even more so than now. I mean, it seems as if DACA is still on the chopping block. I mean, the latest Muslim ban seems to have been struck down yet again. But just curious, you know, what else would you see him potentially doing to capture that imagination of his base, which is shrinking?
I mean, he has to do the Muslim ban. I don't think there's a way out of him doing the Muslim ban at this point. He wouldn't have been elected without the language of the Muslim ban. He threw the dice on this really big time, and it paid off. He bet that Americans hated Muslim people. I mean, that white kind of middle Americans had been scapegoating Muslims for years and years, and he decided to throw like all the money on red on it, basically. And so without that, it's really tough to see it through. The same thing's true of the border wall. So I think he's going to push really hard on that, and he's going to use a lot of coded language around it to do that. I think with DACA, it's difficult, because when he also kind of gave the indication that he might want to preserve DACA, he did it by saying that, well, we're going to have to increase border security. So essentially he's taking a bunch of kids' lives and using them as a betting chip to get what he wants, which is just as ugly as it can be. And of course, without missing a beat, Democrats followed him into that.
Right. You know, militarize the border, more guards. We're going to build the wall. And like you said, using that as a bargaining chip.
And people are going to die because of it. Lots of people are going to die. People die all the time when crossing the border, and it's only going to increase with militarized border security like that. It's just going to, we're going to be talking about kids dying on the way over. Same thing that human rights groups have been, you know, fighting for years. That's what's going to happen.
You know, there's been an article, I think it was in New York Magazine, that was come out. I'm sure you've seen it floating around social media, but it was somebody that went to a county that went for Trump, and it was a county that had swung to Obama before, and, you know, kind of a classic story of, you know, jobs evaporating because of automation and just the economy changing and people, you know, going over to Trump. But, I mean, basically the argument was is that behind kind of these, you know, solidly working class, you know, tensions was like this underlying thing of racism. And one of the people that they talked to in the article, you know, has this racist diatribe against the NFL. I mean, I won't go into what she said, but and some of the debate around social media was just like, you know, almost comes across as kind of this reactionary racist stance is almost nihilistic, because people in the article were saying, like, we don't really give a shit if Trump actually does anything. You know, we just like him because he takes this kind of cultural stance, which we can believe in. And, you know, it strengthens us psychologically, you know, not their words. But I'm just curious, you know, what you think about this. Like, is there kind of like a nihilistic tie to Trump within certain people? And, like, are they, as some would say, beyond redemption?
I don't think people are beyond redemption. Maybe that is like my Protestant upbringing or something. But I do think that there is an absolute nihilism about it. And it brings me back, and I talk about this in the book a little bit. In 2011, the National Policy Institute, which is the kind of large alt-right think tank that Richard Spencer runs, they did this press conference and a report called The Majority Strategy. And if you read it, it essentially says what we already know is that the Republican Party is a white people's party. That's, I think, uncontroversial in a way. And what he thinks would be successful is if they became explicitly the white people's party and not beat around the bush anymore. Because then what you essentially do is follow what business literature says, which is that, you know, 90% of your profits come from 80% or 20% of your customers. So let's get rid of the rest of them and just really focus in on making that more efficient. And that would be a winning strategy. And that's what Trump did. He did the majority strategy almost verbatim. And it won him a lot of base. And what, in a lot of ways, he did, and what the alt-right argues, is returning to a very kind of purist identity politics by saying, okay, this is a party that's going to work in your interest. It's not about ideology necessarily. I mean, it certainly is, but, you know, in terms of their own language, to say it's not about ideology. It's about advocating for your identity. Other people have been advocating for their identities for years. Let's advocate for yourself. And that's, in a way, what it is that maybe the most obvious kind of fascist allegory inside of Trump is that it's not just the kind of racial scapegoating that he's doing, but that he's returning us to an era of strongman politics, that he's just going to be acting in quote unquote white interests. I think the thing that where I walk away from the unredeemable thing is that I don't think he's actually working in any one of those people's interests.
Oh, exactly. I mean, that's to quote Dinesh D'Souza, that's the big lie, you know? It's like, right. It's like, you know, at a time when literally, you know, quote unquote, white working class communities, which are actually poor and working class communities that have multiple racial groups in them. But, you know, white working class people are facing, you know, their water being poisoned, an opioid crisis, you know, automation, a gun to people's heads. I mean, just the decimation of neoliberalism and now Trumpism. And the idea that somehow, like, because he builds a border wall, that's going to, like, make things better. It's like, get the fuck out of here. Like,
right. Yeah. I always hesitate to do too much of the forgiving, the kind of problematic white worker. I mean, there's an impulse to always kind of like, well, they know not what they do. And at a certain point, that's just not true anymore. And also, they don't make, you know, the mythic white worker doesn't make up the majority of the working class, of course. But I do think that there's a certain amount of work that needs to be done to connect with these people, to understand that by giving up privilege, they get solidarity in return. And I wish I had a really great roadmap for how to organize Trump voters back into their interests of abolishing white supremacy. But it's actually really tough road that I don't think I've ever heard someone give a really clear understanding of. You know, it's something that we're seeing. You know, I'm out here in Oregon, and in the rural counties, the large degree they're taken over by patriot militia groups, and they were taken over largely because state services were gone and jobs are gone. So, for example, if someone had a heart attack, it could take hours for an ambulance to get them, but the Oath Keepers will come out and help them. And the when an area where the only stable job in the town might be the post office and they're getting rid of those, there's no meeting space anymore. You know, how are they going to connect about issues or what's going on? They don't have broadband internet. Sometimes they live miles from their neighbors. So it's a kind of world where the right wing has actually been able to go in, provide options to people and create a different narrative. And it's up to us to figure out a way of countering that narrative and bringing it back to collective action.
Yeah, well, in rural Oregon, I mean, you could argue that they've built dual power in a lot of ways.
Yeah, yeah, absolutely. I think, I mean, in a lot of ways, they do effective mutual aid projects, and they create a counter state. And that's something that we should see how it's worked and do and use that as a lesson, because people have turned to those movements for a reason. It's because they've met a need and they've actually took their issues seriously and haven't talked down to them. I mean, the dominant factions of the left, I mean, like the liberal left in cities, are not kind to rural areas. And to generally the working class people broadly, you know, there's a very kind of Bill Maher cynical attitude about it that doesn't have anything there. And why would you want to look to those people if that's the only image you have of a radical left politic? When these people that are coming into your community saying like, no, I do understand you and I care about your issues, you know?
Right. Yeah. I mean, people have to learn from that and push forward. And I mean, I think too, just like finding stuff to organize around and also just back to basics of meeting real needs that aren't there because the state isn't there and it's just us.
Yeah, there have been a lot of efforts to do it. I don't want to take away from them. You know, out here we have the Rural Organizing Project, which is like sort of an NGO project, but they've done a lot of things to try and do that kind of mutual aid system. So, for example, they were going around doing the Save Our Post Office campaign. Because the post office, there's still post offices in towns of 50 to 100 people. And that might be like the only meeting place. There might not even be like a commercial district. And so if people have issues, if there's a crisis, say, you know, the power's cut off for the region for some reason, they go to the post office. And so when the state services are being pulled out, what they were going in and doing was like raising money to create like a community newsletter and maybe some computers at the general store that anyone can use and those basic kinds of things. And actually when in towns where they did that, people who were forming militias stopped forming the militias. They didn't think the need for them anymore because they were building a community outside of that. And so it's sort of like the earliest version of that. I think Redneck Revolt has also done a lot of those projects, like in Appalachia, of doing food distributions at cattle shows, or doing meat needle exchange in areas hit by a fentanyl crisis and stuff like that.
Yeah, and those are great. I mean, we encourage people to write about that for It's Going Down, and we'll blast it out. But I mean, that's good to see. Let's kind of turn back a little bit. You know, what has changed since Charlottesville with the alt-right? What have we seen? You know, we've seen fracturing, we've seen infighting. What's been happening in your analysis in the alt-right itself since Charlottesville?
They've been losing really big time. This is the largest period of decline since they started. And it's the result of organizing. I think there's this feeling that they've done it to themselves, and certainly they've given us the ammo. But it is organizing that has done this purely. It's organizing that got them off their platforms. They've been kicked off of web hosting platforms. They've been kicked off of message boards. They've been kicked off of app integration. They were kicked off of Tinder. Like, they were kicked off of everything.
Right.
It's really hard to be the alt-right right now. So I think the alt-right couldn't have existed in an era before the internet. They just, the way it functions, the anonymity, the you know, blog diarrhea, the tweets, all of it. They couldn't have existed in an era before they were on the same platforms that mainstream figures were on, you know, so they're, you know, politicians and reporters are on Twitter. So are they, you know, they're able to kind of be on at the same wavelengths to a degree, except they're not anymore. And so that's hit them very, very, very hard. So they're kind of in a rebuilding phase of trying to figure out how to create their institutions. The problem is that in the modern kind of internet economy, you can't just create a counter institution and have it work. You know, Gab, which is what they like to use instead of Twitter, no one goes on Gab. So their opinions don't matter on it. Like, I'm not going to go and try and get them kicked off Gab. No one cares about Gab. But, you know, when you're off of Twitter, and Richard Spencer says this all the time. It's like, if you're not on Amazon, if you're not on Twitter, if you're not on Facebook, you don't exist. And I think in a lot of ways, we're making them not exist. That So that's hit them really hard. But they've also had some growths. You know, in 2016, Richard Spencer announced what he was calling the Danger Zone Tour, which is he was going to go to college campuses. And they'd started doing this a while earlier at Berkeley. They did the Berkeley at the Free Speech Plaza. And this was before the kind of the big free speech rallies and stuff. He came with Identity Europa and some people from the white nationalist blog, The Right Stuff, and kind of did like a flash. We're going to appear and just start kind of soapboxing at people. And he thought that was a pretty good format. And then he was able to successfully get on a Texas A&M campus. And what he essentially said was that because commercial institutions are always really subject to pressure, it's pretty easy to get them kicked out of commercial hotels, but it's hard to get them kicked off of public utility locations. So public universities, publicly run venues, things like that. It's pretty difficult to get them kicked out of that. And they were able to successfully sue their way on to some of these locations. They were going to focus in on state schools, and that's what he's done. And that's what he's continuing to do. So they're really focusing heavily on state universities. It's harder to get them banned from there. It's easy to demand security that they don't have to pay for. Students have to pay for it. And so I think they're going to continue to do that. It also, I mean, frankly, they think it's going to be useful to make themselves look like the, you know, embattled free speech advocate. Like, look at these radicals that are taking my American rights away. I don't think anyone really buys that, but it's definitely the argument they want to make. So that's, I think, a big turn that's happened. And the other thing I think is really interesting is that for years and years, the alt-right was developed out of using this sort of European-style fascist language of kind of appropriating the language of the left. So they would like use, for example, post-colonial language, talk about how they were definitely against colonialism. We believe for the nationalism of all peoples. The colonization of Africa is terrible, but so is the colonization of Europe, you know, that kind of anti-imperialist, anti-colonial rhetoric used really disingenuously, and really trying to appeal to a lot of the cultural values of the left by saying, you know, well, we're against this modern capitalist state. It's really alienating, things like that. Kind of the language of the new left. They've started to drop that. And I think it's because they don't feel as though they need to do the crossover act anymore. And so if you start listening to a lot of their blogs and podcasts, they've shifted the rhetoric towards being very pro-colonialist and just saying, like, we really don't care anymore about non-white people. There was a long time where this quote-unquote identitarian movement tried to say that it was identitarianism for everybody. Like, identitarianism will free all folks, people of color, queer people, they'll all be freed by it. But now they simply don't care. So I think it's becoming much more blatant who they are.
It seems that report that came out recently where it said like 55% of white Americans feel that they're under attack really hit them hard. And I think they're really trying to, I mean, England has said this on the Daily Stormer, but you know, we're trying to speak to that base, which to me is ironic because it's like your whole movement is based on how much you hate baby boomers. And now you're saying essentially your entire demographic you want to talk to is like this, you know, growing old generation that feels that they're under attack because the world is passing them by and blah, blah, blah.
Yeah. And I think it's also a result of the fact that they're being kicked off platforms where like they really are creating a very insular bubble. I don't think they have a very good assessment of the rest of the world anymore.
No.
They're not able to see how people actually think about these things. They're not able to see how people actually see them. And so, like, they're assuming that they can mobilize casual racism. But in a lot of ways, the reality of the U.S., and especially like modern capitalism, is that the racism that doesn't go away, that's the kind of baked in white supremacy, refuses to make itself explicit. It's more effective in some ways when it doesn't make itself explicit and when it's just implicit to the system. And so I think most of those people who are like quoting those things would be, oh, I'm horrified by these neo-Nazis, but they continue to behave in, you know, these very kind of obviously white supremacist ways. It doesn't mean that they're going to be able to be flipped to the alt-right. You know, you have to effectively communicate with them, and that's not something they can do.
Right. Well, what do you see about this split going between, you know, Andrew Anglin and Richard Spencer and Identity Europa on one side, and then on another side you have Nationalist Front with Matthew Heimbach, There's a split over optics. One side said that we should kind of rebrand ourselves as American nationalists, not use swastikas, not LARP, not dress up like Nazis, whereas the Nationalist Front is openly National Socialist, and also Heimbach is very much into, I believe the word is Strasserite?
Strasserites, yeah.
But, you know, kind of a left-wing version of Nazism, and, you know, uses a lot of language about class and speaking about working class white communities and stuff like that. Whereas the other side calls Heimbach a communist, doesn't want to have anything to really do with that. England has said, let's just talk about the Jews. We don't need to talk about the economy. What do you make about these splits, and what does that say on both sides?
These are traditional splits. This split has happened before, and it will happen again. Heimbach made a bet a number of years ago that if he doubled down on working class white nationalist movements, he would grow, his organization would grow faster and become more effective. And so he doubled down and on patriot groups, but he also doubled down on kind of like the National Socialist Movement and Klan locals. And he grew really big. I mean, the TWP, the Traditionalist Workers Party, which is Matthew Heimbach's organization, is pretty large. It's over 500 members. And when they have, you know, meetings and stuff, they're pretty big, and they're able to, I think, probably do more effective, quote unquote, activism than the rest of the alt-right, because they were actually doing the work. And so it's a little hard to say, because I think Heimbach has said something which I think is probably pointed, which is that the things that hinder them in terms of optics are also their benefit. And so what I think their strategy in a lot of ways is to scrape the revolutionary radical fringe into one coherent place and hopefully have enough people that they can start a revolutionary movement that way.
But just to push back on that a little bit, I mean, if we looked at Shelbyville, which was a huge bumbling disaster, I mean, they literally beat up a guy that was on his lunch break, a white 20-year-old, and then attacked a woman, out with her African-American boyfriend, bloodied her face. I mean, you know, just totally, you know, had self-described rednecks in a town screaming at them, telling them to go home. I mean, it just looked horrible for them. And they had like, you know, maybe 200 people at the max from what I saw in Shelbyville in Tennessee. And that was like an all hands on deck situation for the Nationalist Front. But you think there's actually more of them in their group?
I mean, I think that's the numbers that we've always had. I think, though, that doesn't mean they're going to all be there. You know, for example, like in California, they have a really huge contingent that probably weren't out there. They were able to recruit from like Sacktown skins and Golden State skinheads and old. And actually, strange enough, they got a lot of old RCP members from what we were reading reports back then that kind of switched to national anarchism and then kind of pulled into their orbit. So I think they might end up being more diffuse, but they have like a regional coordination with like regional captains and things like that. So I think they're actually pretty well organized in comparison to something like Identity Europa, which has a lot of people but hasn't been able to figure out really what effective organizing, like external organizing, looks like. They're still kind of in the let's just create a community kind of phase.
Well, you're saying that you've seen these splits before, either on optics or politics or things like class. This is something that we, you know, said was going to happen too, is that there was going to be a split over class and then movement would have to make a decision. But I mean, in the past, how has white nationalists dealt with these contradictions and these splits?
Yeah, I think it's about whether or not they think they're in a revolutionary moment or if they're in a building phase. You know, like with someone like Richard Spencer, he doesn't think, and I don't think anyone would disagree with him, that the National Socialist Movement is never going to bring a revolution in the U.S. They're bumbling buffoons. And instead, what he wants to do is build a sort of kind of Gromsky model. If he can kind of go after metapolitics, which basically means all the things that come before politics in people's minds, if it can start to change people's attitudes slowly but surely, that will eventually kind of create a new superstructure on top of it. Like, if he can start to get white people to think of themselves as white, to think of themselves as having ethnic interest and ethnic identity, over time, that will change the values of the country or of the world, and therefore will be able to change the politics. I think with Matthew Heimbach, on the other hand, he thinks that that political action needs to happen now and simultaneously with that kind of identity change. But it is a break on class. I mean, it is fundamentally an issue of class in their differences. Someone like Richard Spencer is upper class with graduate degrees and likens himself to an academic, and he talks like an academic. Anytime he tries to talk like a regular person, it's kind of embarrassing. And so like when he bumbles on stage over the last year, you know, there was years when Richard Spencer would just do these academic speeches and he'd be well spoken and he sounds like any professor you ever met. But when he tries to do the like hashtag alt-right Twitter shtick, it's really embarrassing. What ends up being the difference is that line of class. And what Heimbach has always thought was that if you can just focus on the white working class, because not only like they quote unquote being screwed by immigration and multiculturalism, but they're also being attacked by international capitalism. With someone like Anglin, though, I actually think it's completely different than the other two, because Anglin comes from old school Nazism, which thinks it's just the international Jew that's doing everything, and you can't get at anything unless you go after Jewish people, which is, I think, in a world of its own kind of logically, because it lacks any kind of coherent worldview. But yeah, with Heimbach, again, it's going to be about reaching out to working class people as much as possible, and thinking that by doing that and by getting disaffected working class, it's going to get a really big boost. The problem is that in a lot of ways, it's more of like the subtle Richard Spencer thing that works with a lot of the white working class that would be attracted to that more than the Heimbach thing, because like you said, out in places like Shelbyville, they don't want them there. They cause problems. They cause violence. It's really obvious.
How do you see things continuing for them in this period? I mean, what kind of things do you see happening with the alt-right, with these splits in mind, but also just, you know, the period that we're in?
So I think they're going to continue. What they've worked really hard to do over the last 2 years was to create an internal culture of kind of blogs and memes and talking points and all kinds of things. I think they're doubling down on that since they're also being kind of isolated. So I think you're going to see more hyper committed people amongst their cadre. But I also think their outreach is going to wane. And we haven't had a chance yet to see how limited their outreach has been since they've gotten platform denial. It's only been a couple months. It would take a good 6 months to a year to see how their echo chamber actually shrinks. And so I think what we're anticipating is that their ability to reach outside their base is going to be really, really limited. And that, I think, once they realize that that's taking place, that's going to shift the strategy more than anything. But I think they're going to be focusing on college campuses. They're going to be focusing on state-run venues. And they're going to be focusing on trying to continue to have those events. The other thing is that they've kind of stopped the idea manufacturing. Like, they're not really talking about ideas anymore. For years and years, Richard Spencer built the alt-right around this concept that he was going to have like a philosophical movement, and like he was going to mimic the left. You know, if the left has conferences, they're going to have conferences. If the left has heady books about capitalism, so are they. And they're just kind of doing that. That's all stopped. I mean, it's all like issue of the week. Like, we got, you know, they were mocking us on the New York Post, so we're going to do a tweet about it. I mean, that's the kind of culture of it.
Culture war. And they've said that on the alt-right.com. I mean, they argued. They even had an article recently that said, like, the race war will have to wait. We're fighting a culture war.
Yeah, absolutely. And so I think in a lot of ways, the things that they were able to package and sell to a new millennial recruitment of like these, 20, 21-year-old college students, they have a lot less to package now. The other thing is that it used to be that for a period of time, you could be anonymous and be alt-right, or even when you were openly alt-right, they thought that they had kind of saturated the culture enough that it wasn't going to matter. But that's clearly not true. And people are being fired from their jobs or being kicked out of their homes. It's a very big consequence. And for a group of – they're basically recruiting college students who frankly want careers. And they invested money in college and they're hoping to get a good job. Well, you can't when you've been very heavily – the internet has very saturated your Google search results with the fact that you're a neo-Nazi. And so it's just the consequences are really high now, and they're very, very uniform. Like, most people who are active in that movement are being doxxed now, and you can't go under the radar anymore. So I think we're actually about to hit a period where they're going to be hit very hard by their own circumstances, and frankly, by the counter-organizing that's happened.
Yeah, and we're going to talk about that organizing right now. But first, I wanted to ask kind of an overarching question. I mean, you know, they've put forward this kind of like white identity politics thing. I know in the book Kill All Normies, the author argues that kind of the success of the alt-right has been to push back or create a counter narrative to kind of like liberal or quote Tumblr identity politics. I mean, from our perspective, it's, you know, like we don't have that position on identity politics. It's more about like destroying these categories altogether and the systems which create them. And I'm just curious, like, you know, this is something that we've asked a lot of people on this show several times, but just like, so if like we don't support this kind of like liberal, you know, multicultural within capitalism, you know, as long as everybody's represented kind of idea of identity politics, like what's a narrative around that that also like encapsulates our own ideas?
Yeah, I think this is where this is one of the things that people kind of get at each other's throats at a bit. But we have to be honest about it too. Like, I think that there's an imperative on us to, instead of just advocating for identities, but to kind of abolish the conditions by which oppressed identities are forged in a way.
Yeah.
And I think that's really important. One of the things that Spencer Sunshine said to me that always resonated was that fascism is in of itself a critique on the flaws of the left. And what the alt-right has picked up on, like most fascist movements pick up on, is the use of identity politics on the left and them trying to just see that through. Like, we need to be really clear that, like, leftist identity politics are not the same as right-wing ones. They don't come from the same place. They're not, like, disastrous in the way that white identitarian politics are.
Right.
But what they want to do is they want to take that language. And so I think it's, like, kind of on us to be more coherent and really understand the consequences of the way we suggest things, and to not just kind of reduce our discussion of oppressed identities to like the framework that's provided in liberal discourse about it, because we want to reject that discourse entirely.
Right. That's a great answer. Well, let's talk about the organizing that's gone on in the last year. I mean, we were just looking back on, we just shared on Twitter again, this kind of roundup post of readings and stuff called Trump the Regime, that was kind of like an introduction for people that were coming into, you know, anti-Trump, anti-racist action. And there was a list of things that were going on right before Trump got inaugurated up until after. And, you know, just there was the Milo tour, there was, you know, against the MPI conference, all the anti-Trump stuff, you know, everything that happened to J20. I mean, there's just so much going on, you know, massive conferences and assemblies being organized and everything. I mean, when you look back at the past year, I mean, what's your analysis of it as far as, you know, what was successful and what wasn't?
Well, I think there was a period of time, a reactive period of time, when there was these huge kind of, I guess, assemblies and kind of convergence of people. And that was exciting, but that never lasts beyond what people make sustainable, essentially. And what I think, and so there was a lot of kind of rise and fall of projects in that period, which is to be expected whenever there's a large incident. But I think what has been successful is that sustained organizations that got energized during that period have maintained themselves. And so we see a lot of anti-fascist groups that have stuck around past their initial phases. And then also anti-fascist groups that have been there for years that are just kind of getting even more kind of public and efficient and bringing in new people. So I think that there's been a certain amount of success in that. I think other projects it wasn't just when Trump was elected, but in the ramp up to it, they began working. And I think that they were able to gain energy and become more sustainable. Redneck Revolt was one of them. The General Defense Committee from the IWW has, I think, been very public and grown a lot, and is starting to have different chapters all over the place and is doing great work. A lot of organizations are also trying to figure out kind of unique approaches. So like, what's their unique angle to this, that they bring something different? And if we're going to look at something like mass movement anti-fascism, it means filling different pieces of a puzzle. So like an interesting group around Portland, where I'm at, is the Pacific Northwest Anti-Fascist Workers Collective, which has done, they do a lot of things, but they really come at it from like a labor angle. A lot of them are trade unionists. And so they try and use the resources and connections that they have there to bring it into it. So, for example, supporting anti-fascist prisoners getting out of jail to get jobs, or training in trade union apprenticeship programs, which a lot of times will hire felons, but will also be really good jobs. You know, like you can have a full career in one of these building trades. So I think that's a unique angle, and also just really mobilizing people in unions, and especially in building trades, where a lot of in the 90s, a lot of kind of skinhead convicts, fascist skinhead convicts had gone into, now trying to do the work of using the union functions to kind of go after white nationalists that are trying to hide in those unions. So I think that's like a unique approach that's happening. And I think a lot of people are trying to see like what kind of unique angle can we bring to this that adds something to the puzzle and doesn't just take away from another organization's work.
Yeah, there's just been so much stuff going on. And I mean, there's been so many interesting turns to this, too. I mean, you know, I was just reading an article the other day on the Washington Post about a protest that happened at Virginia Tech. And, you know, they were just quoting from, you know, information that had been gathered from anti-fascists there. And, you know, before, like a couple months ago, they wouldn't have even bothered to even acknowledge that those people exist, and now it's like they pretty much have to. I'm just curious, like looking back at what's happened over the past year, and especially after Charlottesville, do you think like any of the liberal narratives or any of the stuff that centrists usually say has been laid to waste?
Yeah, I think so. I mean, I think reality has kind of kicked them in the face. You know, the murder of Heather Heyer, I think, is a really good example. You know, there's this notion that on the one hand, if you ignore them, they go away, which is just empirically false. At this point, we can't even entertain that kind of thing. But the other one, that they're kind of small and they're not important, and they don't actually engage in anything that is substantive. This comes from both the left and the center. And that's also been being proven false. The media in general has been pretty poor at covering this. And I'm not even saying that from a, you know, the mainstream media is bankrupt. It very well may be, but I think it's actually a functional thing. They don't have the capacity to understand a lot of this. It's very outside their frame of reference, both the kind of the fascist and the anti-fascist. And so it's been tough for them to actually keep up with what's going on. And local anti-fascist groups have the advantage of saying, we'll just focus on this area and we'll just do deep research and we'll all spend a lot of time on it to get really accurate information. And so when in the past you might just rely on like the Southern Poverty Law Center or somewhere that has resources to do the research, there's actually like groups in most towns now that are doing research on the people in their area and getting accurate information. So like in Portland, you know, Roasted Antifa has done this for over 10 years now. And they have a really high standard, a really high bar for accurate information. You know, they check the facts. They make sure it's good to go. They don't just throw out whatever, whenever. They make sure it's good, reliable, so that their credibility stays up and that people can find it useful when they're doing organizing work. And so I think that's actually kind of blowing out of the water the old media infrastructure that we had to rely on just to get information.
Well, you know, leading up to this, we talked about the concept of mass anti-fascism. What does this actually mean, and how have we seen this in action over the past couple months, and what do you think the possibilities for this kind of model is?
I think with mass anti-fascism, what just distinguishes it is an approach to relying on mass action rather than just a cadre. And so in a lot of ways, I think what this means is approaching situations with trying to engage as many people as possible as being part of an effective praxis. So an example, I think, would be recently here in Portland. We had the recent in May, the stabbing of the three people on a public transportation in kind of an Islamophobic rage. And shortly thereafter, that person who did the stabbing had been a part of these right wing free speech rallies. So the people who were organizing those rallies decided, OK, we'll do another one, even though it was wildly unpopular, obviously. So the organizations involved in counter-organizing organized thousands of people to confront this. This was not just going to be a couple people, you know, I don't know, having a brawl on the streets or something. It was going to be really the entire community revolted against it. And what the advantage of that is, one, tactical, you know, thousands of people can do what hundreds of people can't. The same thing being true after Charlottesville in Boston, when some Proud Boys and other alt-right people wanted to have a rally, and they were met by 40,000 people. I mean, that just shuts down everything. Yeah. But it also has the ability of transforming the community by getting people involved, maybe for the first time, getting them educated on the issues, trying to go after maybe the issues that come before the alt-right. Well, what about the issues of institutional white supremacy or police violence? Let's talk about those too. And so it has the ability of really getting a lot of people mobilized, and then also finding a place for a lot of people that might not have a place in other types of organizations. You know, there's a lot of people, I don't know, families, or maybe folks that are retired and have limited time or whatever it may be, finding a place for them and making anti-fascism something that's not just for a few people, but for anyone can really be involved in some capacity. And I think that actually raises its potential as being kind of a revolutionary movement that can really go after big issues, because it transforms the culture and the community at the same time.
Well, that's a perfect segue into our next question. But recently on It's Going Down, we published an essay that looked at a lot of the nativist and white nationalists that have come out of the organization FAIR, or Federation of Americans for Immigration Reform. Some of these people have gotten appointments through the Trump administration. They're working at places like the Department of Homeland Security. They're advisors to ICE and stuff like that. I mean, pretty scary stuff. But I'm just curious. It seems like a problem for us that we've been able to identify people within the broader culture like Richard Spencer, but when they're actually entering into the government and they're directing policy and they're, organizing police action and stuff like that. I mean, like, if you look at somebody like Kobach, am I saying it right? I don't know. The guy that's
Kobach, yeah.
Kobach that's doing the voter fraud panel. I mean, they're actively trying to come up with a system that will kick millions of people off of the rolls across the United States. I mean, things that would have a huge impact on people's lives. And I'm just curious, if we're talking about mass anti-fascism, what about these people that, maybe they're not going out and flying a swastika flag at Unite the Right, but I mean, they're definitely coming from within this movement.
Yeah, I think they have a kind of a different role in a lot of ways, because they are the ones that are going to try and influence policy. So FAIR, the Federation for American Immigration Reform, is a part of what we call the TANT network, which has been a network of really heavy anti-immigrant organizations with ties to open white nationalism. It really is the institutionalization of white nationalism. It's not just a coded thing. In a lot of ways, stuff like Breitbart really is made up of conservatives who code word white nationalist stuff. The FAIR on the other end is actually the best possible policy outcomes for white nationalists. It's what they could get. And so I think in a lot of ways, they do set the conversation about what they're going to do. And that might be okay, because then we can go after them based on supporting immigrants and those attacked by anti-immigrant policies. They really do sever ties with open white nationalists when they engage in these power. You're not going to see Chris Kobach at American Renaissance. And so I think approaching them in the way that we approach the insurrectionary contingent of white nationalists is going to be unsuccessful. And so I think anti-fascists in general have kind of gone after that as saying, like, we need to prioritize the language of supporting immigrants, supporting, folks on DACA, for example, and making that a really strong component of it. It can't just be confronting these kind of marginal movements that pose a violent threat, but also creating the mass movement that can support immigrants and make sure that as an issue is kind of covered.
Right. Well, we have to really center that, like you're saying. Well, I want to turn now towards Roy Moore and Steve Bannon. I mean, if you've been watching the news, you've been seeing that Roy Moore is definitely in the hot seat. Several people have come forward saying that he assaulted them and that he was engaged in sexual relationships with teenage women throughout his life. There's a kind of a weird thing that's happened. Well, it's not weird at all, but I mean, people within the far right and the alt-right are coming to defend him. I saw Baked Alaska was saying things online like Roy Moore did nothing wrong. I mean, it's just...
Yeah, that's what Roy Moore needs. He needs a bunch of white nationalists to come defend him. That'll take him out of the hot seat.
Right. I mean, in many ways, it's very disgusting, but it's also, it's ironic that these same people that were screaming about Pizzagate or right. or people that have spent the last couple of weeks, you know, pointing at Hollywood saying, like, look at these quote unquote left wing people and their degeneracy. And, you know, here it is on their doorstep. But I mean, what do you make of Moore and what Bannon is trying to create in the South? People have described Moore as a Christian nationalist. I mean, how does he fit into your framework and your analysis of fascism in the United States?
I mean, I think that Roy Moore makes up the same kind of populist wing that Trump came in on, and that Bannon really wants to take advantage of. More than anything, Bannon is a populist. He supports the kind of movements of like the Front National in France or Brexit in the UK, these kind of right-wing populist movements that maybe don't meet the full barometer of going full fascist, but really are necessary for fascism to have like a big wave. Without that, it's just people in small conferences you've never heard of. So I think Roy Moore really makes up a part of that. You know, Roy Moore is a high-grade piece of shit, and it's really hard to see how even his rhetoric is going to play super well. I say that, you know, with something like the allegations of sexual assault, which sound, you know, like that's the kind of thing that should ruin someone's career. And that's what we'd expect to have happen. But, you know, just weeks before the election, those things happened with Trump and he just didn't care. He just stepped over it. And most people didn't just stepped over it with him. And so I'd like to think that since the Harvey Weinstein issue came up, that maybe there's a cultural wave that's going to disallow, you know, a sexually predatory piece of shit like that in. But it's hard to I can't like set my watch to that. That being said, if he does win, that sets the precedent that new bar of sort of like anti-elitist far right rhetoric is acceptable. It's a step up from Trump. I mean, it's a step worse in a lot of ways from the Trump rhetoric. And I think Bannon's going to use that as an opportunity to raise lots of money by showing that this kind of campaign is effective and that let's go for this in 2020 also. And so I think like that's what the potential is. You know, one of the things about Trump winning was that he set the precedent for possibly rebranding the GOP as a right populist organization by showing that it wins in a world where the GOP, frankly, wasn't doing very well for a long time. It kind of lost its identity. Mm-hmm. And Trump is an option for that identity, and Roy Moore even more so. It's in a lot of ways, Trump is not a Christian candidate. I mean, there's nothing traditionally Christian about Donald Trump. And I would say probably same is true of Roy Moore, but he's able to speak to Christians a little bit better. But, you know, and if we look at like the kind of surveys and studies that were done after the election, you know, Christians obviously overwhelmingly came out for Trump, but they did not come out for him. And because of his Christian ideas, they came out because it was a power grab and they thought that he would give them what they wanted. And so I'm wondering if they even need to play this Christian game anymore as much as they have in the past and instead say, hey, look, you want, you know, a new Supreme Court seat, we'll give it to you, that kind of thing. Like, I think it's actually that cynical in a lot of ways.
Oh, yeah, totally. I mean, and people say that all the time. They're like, you know, Trump's not perfect, but he's going to protect the babies or something like that.
Right, right, right. And I think in a lot of ways, they boiled Christian voters down to single issues like abortion and then think that they can give them an easy give on that.
Right. And that's an excellent point, too, that you brought up. And a lot of people have been saying this about, you know, Trump has been accused of sexual assault, rape. I mean, again and again, and still it's not sticking.
I mean, he was being accused of sexually assaulting like middle school age girls.
Yes, yes.
And no one cared. Like mainstream outlets didn't even pick it up. And actually, and frankly, in stories, they called her a liar. I mean, it was quite shocking, and even more shocking that like it was very little said about it.
Right. And even Trump was also friends with some other billionaire guy that had like sex parties in which there were underage like children there. And I mean, this came out and it's disgusting.
Yeah. And I think there's a kind of a culture too on the right. And a lot of people have covered it and I don't need to rehash it of like calling anything you don't want like fake news. And really just kind of honing in on what you want and how to get it and avoiding information anywhere else. Like, did Roy Moore do this? I know the left-wing media lies. I don't believe a word they say. I'm voting for this guy, you know? And I think that's actually in a lot of ways they've cultivated that, and it's a winning strategy for them. Bannon cultivating that makes an absolute winning strategy. Let's avoid facts. Let's avoid the truth. Just get them, tell them you're going to get what you want. Vote this way.
Okay. Yeah, one more turn here. But, I mean, this past week, one of the big stories with the alt-right that's come out is these this firing campaign, It's Okay to Be White. And we're seeing online, more and more flyers from Identity Europa on college campuses. The SPLC has put out a report entitled How to Deal with the Alt-Right on Your Campus, which is all about, you know, going to the administration and, you know, having a protest far away from them if they come and stuff like that. But, I mean, for people that are going to school or in these communities where these firing campaigns are happening, what advice would you give them? Because this seems like an excellent thing for people to counter, especially if they're looking for a way to get involved in some of this stuff that we're talking about today.
Yeah, I mean, like, look, try to use these things as opportunities to mobilize people and show that there's a real issue happening here, that something's actually taking place, and that the only way to go about it is to actually organize presence and to disallow them on campus. A lot of groups have put pressure on the administration and put in policies in place. Whether or not that's effective, I'm not entirely sure. I think that what's always effective is having mass contingents on campus. I mean, policies mean nothing without the enforcement of students. They can have any policy they want. It's not going to do anything unless there's people there forcing them to do it. And so that's really what makes this thing work, is having campus anti-fascist groups doing organizing work that can confront it. That's even true of the SPLC. I mean, they have a campus group, for example, on Columbia that was, you know, confronting Mike Cernovich just the other day and stuff. So I think actually having contingents that are going to go up against and disallow this is really critical. Identity Europa and campaigns like It's Okay to Be White. And what they want to do is enter into the conversation, you know, because the point of like a meme like that is to say, well, why isn't it okay to be white? Why do you think that's fascist?
As if anybody was saying that to begin with.
Right, right. And so it's important, I think, on us to obviously be able to explain why that's total bullshit and why it's just a kind of a trigger point to get people to kind of flip over. But to also just say, like, no, we're not going to do this here. I mean, they want more than anything to be a part of the conversation. So we'll just stop that conversation, like, stop them from being able to enter into those conversations because they're not actually bringing anything productive to it. And so I think on campuses, using those as opportunities to create an actual counter groups that can do organizing work over the long term is really important. If we walk out from every instance of Turning Point or Identity Europa or Vanguard America on college campuses with groups formed that are going to go after them, then we're going to be way stronger than they'll ever be, because we'll have longevity in comparison to them and we'll be able to actually go after this in a longer way.
Right. Well, one question that came from Twitter today, it says, where do you see evidence of techno-fascism in daily life? And we were talking about, we don't necessarily know exactly what this means, but I mean, you know, just in the past couple weeks, you know, we've seen a robot now be given citizenship in Saudi Arabia. AI is becoming more and more of a thing. You know, when we're talking about fascism, do you see that there's going to be an interplay with, you know, authoritarian aspects of the government and technology, or is that not the real question?
I think it's really hard to say. When I hear questions like this, what I kind of read from it sometimes is what they mean is, do you think that there's going to be an authoritarian technology? And what they're doing is there's this kind of meme that fascism means authoritarianism. And it doesn't. It means something different. It doesn't give state authoritarianism a pass or anything. But, you know, if you look at, you know, interwar fascism, those are primitive states that could only dream of the apparatus that the U.S. has now. And so those are kind of, to a degree, separate issues. But I think the question is whether or not they could merge. And that could definitely, I mean, intense surveillance technology into a white nationalist organization or like a state that goes in that direction is really frightening. And so I don't think we should always assume that technology is neutral and that it is in and of itself whoever drives the boat on this. But I don't think necessarily it signals one way or the other. You know, the alt-right couldn't have existed without this technology that it's using now, social media and mass outreach and things like that. But to a degree, the level of anti-fascist coordination couldn't have existed either. And so I think it ends up depending on, when we look at technology, it is going to have to depend on who's reigning it to a degree. And so I think with something like the increased use of AI and surveillance technologies, there's a lot to be worried about there. It's debatable whether it's the same worry as the kind of growth of white nationalism.
Mm-hmm. Well, Shane, thanks so much for coming on the program. Again, check out the book. It's published on AK Press, Fascism Today, What It Is and How to End It. Check it out. Shane, anything else you want to say where can people read more of your stuff? How can they follow you?
So you can follow me on Twitter, just kind of through Shane Burley. I'll have articles coming out in other places, Color Lines and other folks, and I'll be at the Howardson Book Fair on August 19th, and then I'll have a number of other dates coming up soon.
Awesome. Hey, thanks so much for coming on the program, and best of luck to you and all your endeavors, and always enjoy seeing more of your writing.
Yeah, absolutely. I love what's going on at It's Going Down, so thanks for having me on.
Thanks a lot. Feeling some kind of way, I hustle every day.
We all out for self in a world that's consumed by greed and wealth. It's a dog eat dog, and we cannibals for capital. The will to survive in the animal is natural, but the desire to rule in the pursuit of pure power is the path of the fool. We chase crowns till we laying face down. Our worldly possessions keep weighing us down. In rain clouds, I move like a quiet storm. No shroud, stand proud, why should I conform? Beyond the norm, I exceed the hype. Beyond all the bullshit and the stereotypes. Throw this in your stereo, this is my life. On a day so dark, you would swear it was night. Knife came with the beat to help me carry the light. So you can stand your ground, whatever the fight. You work for yours like I work for mine. On some P-Rod shit, got a perfect grind. What's next from the west like I'm first in line? From the coast that's known for the surf and shine. Write rhymes like I'm trying to save the earth in time. Before my girls get big and give birth to mine. I encourage you to live, put the worst behind. Never worry about the past, it ain't worth your time. I know and let me put it in this flow. We got all the goods we need, but got no money to grow. Hood got all the coke and weed, but got no profit to show. Junkies got a scene of speed, but their brain is moving slow. Education at an all-time low, still catch an all-time high. Off the kush, Dr. Green Thumb grow. I ain't preaching, I'm just giving you a real 24. It's a cold world, these streets don't feel anymore. There's no way of telling what turned rebelling streets to three-time felons. Some people's government to big-time villains. Robbers flying, stealing, just the way it is. Take you for a gang of loop, but $20 got you out here slaying kids. Now tell me why is that? They blame the lies and rap. But what about the medium bullshit they disguising that? How we got access to ammo in any size of cat? But we can't get a decent school for us to knowledge at. It's called implied malice. They know they turned us into crime addicts. On the block chasing superficial status. Now do the mathematics. How many of us die in war? On the street or for all who's keeping score? The same cops we pay to protect the service. And the country turns its back, even though you fight for it in service. When it comes to my life, it's never one problem. You never know about it till you walk the shoes that I'm in.